A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on December 17, 2000, entitled, The Lost Cause of Christmas. The texts for the sermon are 1 Samuel 2, verses 1 through 8, and Luke 1, verses 46 through 56. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Last week I spoke a bit about Christmas and its drivenness and the frenzy of this season that can be so distracting from us that we fail, ironically, to do the very thing the Advent season is for, which is to wait, to be quiet, to contemplate. And I did that because I think it's an important fact for us to become aware of, to be conscious of. I didn't really do it being Reverend Grinch, throwing a wet blanket on your celebrations, and it was not one more preacher's harangue about keeping Christ in Christmas or scolding you for the commercialization of the day. I did at the door pick up a little guilt, a little defensiveness. But I hope that you understand that that's not how I understand preaching. My task is not really to scold you or to drive you or impose guilt upon you. What I understand I do up here is hold up a slice of life and invite you to think about it. Invite you to think with me about it. In order that we might come to full consciousness of our lives. In order that we might come to an awareness so that we live our lives and are not simply lived. In order that we might live from the inside out. And so I try to hold up that slice of life and invite you to think with me. This is really a conversation. In fact, it's the most wonderful conversation in the world because I'm the only one who gets to talk. But I hope you are invited to think about it with me and receive it not as some authoritarian proclamation, some declaration from above, some dogmatic utterance which is absolute. It's more often tentative. Someone went out last week and said, now, apparently agreeing that the days could be frenzied and we could be driven in our life, she went out and said, now next week tell me how to unplug. Well, as a matter of fact, we can't unplug. As a matter of fact, we are so thoroughly woven into the fabric of our cultural experience that what we have to do is learn to live with attention. And the only way that we can overcome that drive that would snuff out the spirit and stifle the emergence of spirit in our lives is through awareness and consciousness. But we cannot disengage from our social, political, economic structures, the whole social context in which we live. We could try to escape life somehow, maybe flee to a monastery or a convent, but that's not possible for most of us. We're going to have to deal with life in all of its variety, in all of its diversity, in all of its seductiveness, and all of its pressure. And in the midst of that, do our best to live with awareness that we might be intentional, that we might realize our fullest humanity and our greatest potential. So don't receive my word as some word from above with absolute truth. I saw a cartoon in the New Yorker the other day and I clipped it out. You can imagine the scene in the background. It was probably the Himalayas. And there was a cave in front of which was sitting one of these Eastern gurus. And there was a young man sitting in front of him with his backpack on, you know. And the caption under the cartoon was, "Don't you think if I knew the meaning of life, I wouldn't be sitting in this cave in my underpants?" And that's the way I feel often when I prepare to come here to try to say something that has some significance, that would be enough significance to get you out on a Sunday morning in a blizzard, when you might well read the paper with a cup of coffee. So hear me again this morning as I address the idea of the lost cause of Christmas. And by the lost cause of Christmas, I want to set before you the almost impossibility of us celebrating the Christmas miracle as it originated in this world. I want you to think with me this morning about the fact that for us, for people like us, it is almost impossible to observe Christmas according to its original meaning and intention. Almost impossible. Almost impossible because the Christmas story is a story about a revolutionary movement toward liberation. It has a particular historical, social, economic, political context. And in the last decades, we are becoming more and more aware of the times of Jesus, the time of Jesus' birth, the nature of the life of the average person, the majority of which were peasants at the time that Jesus came into this world. I hope this afternoon sometime you'll take a moment and read a page in your liturgy from a book, The Message of the Kingdom, by Richard Horsley and Neil Silverman. Horsley has another excellent book that I did not quote called The Liberation of Christmas. And these scholars have taken what we know now about the concrete historical context of Jesus' birth and life, and in setting that forth, have come to understand the birth stories as I believe they were intended when they were written by Matthew and by Luke. The context of the world into which Jesus came was a world in which the people of Israel, God's people, Jesus' people, were an occupied people by a foreign power, a backwater province in a vast Roman Empire, and there was social disruption brought about by heavy taxation, loss of land, movement to cities, and the ever-present Roman legions. It was a world that was spoken of as the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. The Romans were not bad people. In fact, they were wonderful administrators. They are still revered for the law, the administration of government, of which they were geniuses. But nonetheless, the bottom line was the Roman legion. And there was the exploitation and the oppression of the poor of the provinces. And the people to whom Jesus came were a marginalized people who were voiceless and powerless. And the Song of Mary is a revolutionary ballad. The closest I could come to thinking about a parallel in our own experience would be the song, We Shall Overcome. There's tremendous power in music, tremendous emotional power that unites and bonds human beings in a cause or in a movement. And those songs in Luke's Gospel, the Magnificat, which I read a moment ago, the Song of John, the Benedictus, the Song of Simeon, the Nunc Dimittis, those songs, which were based on the psalmody of the people of Israel past, Mary's particularly, as I mentioned, very much dependent on the Song of Hannah. Those songs that celebrated the birth of Jesus were revolutionary ballads which celebrated the mighty act of God moving for the liberation of God's people. The mighty cast down from their thrones, the lowly lifted up, the hungry fed, the rich turned empty away. The world is turned upside down in those songs. The way the world is experienced by those poor and dispossessed people is turned upside down. There's a reversal of circumstance. And God is praised in the spirit of doxology with great joy. Because now God has acted, God has moved. And those songs and the birth stories of Matthew and Luke are probably some of the earliest records we have of that early Jesus movement that was a revolutionary movement looking for a change of historical circumstance. Moving from being the underdog to the possibility of a humane existence. I don't think that if we look at those songs carefully and if we put them into the context of which we are becoming more and more aware, the social, historical, economic, political context of the time of Jesus, there can be any question about that. Those songs continue that grand tradition of the Hebrew prophets who saw the possibility of an alternative world, of an alternative kind of community. And so, I say to you what must be obvious. It is extremely difficult for us to celebrate Christmas in its original meaning and significance, because we just have nothing in common with the poor, marginalized, voiceless, and powerless people among whom Jesus was born. We naively identify with those people. We put ourselves in the skin of Zacharias and Elizabeth and Mary and Simeon and Anna, the people of Israel to whom the Lord came. But as a matter of fact, if we're honest, we're on the other side of the line. We are Rome. We are empire. We are affluent, we are powerful. We call the shots in our world. And for us to celebrate Christmas in its original meaning and significance is to undercut ourselves. And the status quo, which is dealt very kindly with us. Now, that isn't so profound, and I think it must be clear if we think about it for a moment. The reason that Jesus was crucified, my old Lenten theme, put as concisely as I can, he died the way he died because he lived the way he lived. The authorities, ecclesiastical and political of the day of Jesus, rightly saw him as a threat to the world as it was organized at that time. And any time a world is organized at any time, those who are the power brokers are not going to want that world to be changed. And they're not going to be happy with a prophetic voice that suggests an alternative possibility. So I simply make the point for us to celebrate Christmas is pretty much of a lost cause. So what have we done? Well, I talked about one possibility last week. We've made a holiday out of it. And it's a wonderful holiday. Friends gathering together, families coming home, beautiful trees and flowers, the sights and sounds and fragrances of the season, all the remembrances of Christmases past, all of that wonderful, beautiful, warm human experience. Nothing wrong with that. We've made the Christmas mystery and miracle into a wonderful holiday. I emerged from my lofty perch last night only to find that Nancy was surfing. When Nancy surfs, she's bored. Now, on most Saturday nights, she's bored because I'm incommunicado. From about Saturday noon until I get here in the morning, I grunt, that's all. But I emerged long enough to come down into the bedroom where she was surfing the TV, only to see that Lawrence Welk had arisen from the dead, and there he was. And it was the conclusion of what must be a famous Christmas special that's probably trotted out every year about this time. And I entered just at the end of the program where Lawrence Welk said, "And here comes Santa Claus." And Santa Claus came out in all of his regalia and all of his splendor. And the band struck up, "Joy to the World, the Lord has come." And I said to her, "God has just spoken to me. I'm going to write this down so I don't forget it." Precisely, precisely. This wonderful holiday. Santa Claus comes and the band plays, "The Lord has come. Joy to the world." In the church, we've done another thing with it. In the church, we managed to celebrate Christmas by moving it from its original intention as a social protest, as a social critique. We've moved it to the personal experience of salvation. We sang it a moment ago as a supplication in one of my favorite carols, "O Little Town of Bethlehem." "Cast out our sin and enter in. Be born in us today." It's wonderful. Nothing wrong with that either. Personal experience of being in communion with God, being at peace with God, the experience of grace and forgiveness. My goodness, how could I be against that? It's very, very important. It's just that that's really not what Christmas was about. Christmas was about an alternative kind of community, a different kind of society, different power arrangements, different economic arrangements. Now, if Jesus had been about personal salvation, if Jesus had gone about to people and said, "Are you saved? This is how you can be saved. If you repeat this formula, if you believe in me, your sins will be forgiven, and you will have the hope of heaven, the promise of something in another time, in another world." The Gospels were not good news about the fact that a person can be reconciled with God through Jesus Christ. Paul talks about that, but then Paul thought the end was right around the corner. And so he was excited about the fact that this treasure of Israel was for all people, and all people could come into this experience of grace in this God of Israel. And of course he identified this with the death and resurrection of Jesus. But you don't find that in the Gospels. The birth stories in Luke, obviously, if he's going to put a preface to his gospel, which is about the life and the ministry and the teaching of Jesus, he's going to tell you in those birth stories that prelude to the gospel how he understands this Jesus. And how he understood this Jesus, according to the gospel that we read every Christmas, is that this one was the act of the eternal God coming into human experience in the flesh of Mary's child in order to change the world. But we've been able to salvage some of the spirituality and the piety of the holiday by turning it into the possibility of personal salvation and making of our Christian religion, frankly, a salvation cult. That's what we are. And we invite people to faith in Jesus, to receive forgiveness, and have then heaven's gates opened wide. Go through your hymnal, read your Christmas carols, and just see how we have domesticated and spiritualized the story of the birth of Jesus. I don't mean to ruin the carols for you, but if you read them perceptively over against what was quite obviously the intention in the original story, you'll find that we have made of this revolutionary liberation document and event a matter of personal piety and salvation. Well, what are we to do? What are we to do? We can recognize, for one thing, that throughout the centuries, the Christmas story has regained here and there its original intention, because there have been peoples who have read the story and found hope and been inspired and have initiated movements toward liberation and freedom. Most recently, in our own experience, we know of liberation theology that originated among the poor, particularly in Latin and South America, in what they call base communities, where the poor folk, the peasant folk, would come together and in homes, and they would study the Gospels, and they actually read themselves into the story. As I said a moment ago, we tend to identify with Anna and Simeon and Mary and all of them, when really we have to identify ourselves with the Roman Empire. Well, these base communities of people that are dispossessed and socially outcast, marginalized and powerless, They read themselves into the story, and they are able to identify with it, and it has become a tremendous source of ferment and a movement toward more justice and equity, and it's had that revolutionary intent. That revolutionary intent has been realized in many of those communities. Interestingly, the Vatican has silenced some of the leading voices of liberation theology, because the Church, in order to maintain its establishment status, doesn't want to rock the boat and get a peasant rebellion going. And so the Church has officially said, you may not talk about the original meaning of Christmas, continue to speak about saving souls. You can have the most wonderful personal spiritual experience in the world and no one's going to care. You can be just as pious, just as devoted, just as full of faith, just as sure of your salvation as possible. And there is not a tyrant or a dictator or a politician anywhere that will bother you. It's only when you begin to speak and act like Jesus did that you get into trouble. But the stories have been a stimulus for that through the years, through the centuries. But still, here we are. What are we going to do? How are we going to celebrate Christmas? Being in the position we are. Here I am, white, male, affluent, powerful. The nation went through an extended period of time without knowing which candidate for the presidency actually won. Now we know. Then some voices are being raised about the fact that there are minority groups that have been disenfranchised. And I don't suppose we're ever going to know the full story of everything that went on, or really who got what number of votes. But I wonder if there is anything to that. Is it a fact that minority people were herded down to get registered, and that they went to vote, and once they went there, they didn't really know what they were about, what they were doing? That's a possibility, isn't it? And one shouldn't be too surprised about that. And the Electoral College originally was instituted, for whatever reasons you might defend it or attack it today, originally it was in order to ensure that the elite would rule. And as a matter of fact, you know what? When the elite rules, things go better. For people like me, at least, they do. But now I wonder if there is anything to this fact that it is the poor and the marginalized, that were they really disenfranchised? Jesse Jackson says so. I don't like Jesse Jackson. And I worry about the fact that I don't like him because he's black. And I really ask myself, is it because he's black that you don't like him? Is it because he's black that your first response is negative? Well, I don't think it is. I think it's because of the curl of his lip and the shape of his mustache. But then my mother didn't like my mustache either. So I have to say, he comes on the screen, I don't want to hear him. And when he talks about a mass demonstration of minority folk on Martin Luther King's birthday in January, I say, Jesse, we've just been through a rather strenuous period of time. Can't we get on with life? Can't you drop it? You're nothing but an opportunist anyway. Why don't you just let it go? And then I realized that I'd jolly well like it to be let go. In fact, I wouldn't change anything if it were up to me, if nobody complained. If there wasn't somebody out there, a gadfly, an irritant, a revolutionary, with all of his flaws and all of his foibles, if there wasn't somebody agitating, I wouldn't do anything about the world. What can a white male, heterosexual, powerful, affluent person do to capture something of Christmas? If I were a woman, I would use the revolutionary ballads to get equal rights. If I were a person of homosexual orientation, I would use it in order to gain respect and dignity and be accepted just as a human being. But I'm on top of the heap. Any protest that changes anything is going to diminish my privileged position. How can I celebrate Christmas? Holiday cheer, revel in my personal salvation, and then these words from Rudy Wiebe. I don't know who he is, but I like what he wrote. Jesus says, in his society, there is a new way for people to live. You show wisdom by trusting people. You handle leadership by serving. You handle offenders by forgiving. You handle money by sharing. You handle enemies by loving. You handle violence by suffering. In fact, you have a new attitude toward everything, toward everybody, toward nature, toward the state in which you happen to live, toward women, toward slaves, toward all and everything. Because this is a Jesus society, and you repent, not by feeling bad, but by thinking different. Maybe the only way I can be honest with Christmas and honest to God is to work at thinking different.